Right, the topic is Chumrah as a rhetorical device in Igrot Moshe. So I understand that that's could be a confusing title. What does that mean, Chumrah as a rhetorical device? I hope it becomes clear as we go along. So first, start with an introduction. Right, we all have heard of the idea of Chumrah. You know, it's usually something that we complain about, and you know, especially when other people do it. Obviously, when we do it, it's normal. When somebody else does it, it's gone overboard. There are lots of different categories of Chumrah, and it's something that's really, you know, the guy who's really begun to study it is the author of the article that I sent out, Benjamin Brown. You know, he's doing a lot of work on modern Haredi'ut. Right, he's written on, as you saw, on the Mishnah Brura. He's written on the Chazon Ish. He's written on Haredi'ut in the, you know, in the Yishuv, like in Eretz Yisrael. And he's also written a lot on modern Chumrah. Like he lists five categories of modern Chumrah in the writings of various thinkers, various Haredi thinkers. And it's real, you know, he's really doing a lot of the work. He hasn't addressed Rav Moshe on this issue. You know, perhaps it's another category, but as we see, I think that it's, I don't know if I would call Rav Moshe another category of Chumrah, as we'll see. In essence, there are two basic divisions for, you know, when we talk about Chumrah. You know, this is by way of introduction. One idea of Chumrah is that I'm going beyond what is required. Right? I'm going me'al me'aver what I have to do. It's something that's super erogatory. It's something that I don't need to do. And the second type of Chumrah is that I'm acting out of concern that this may in fact be required. Right? One is that I know that it's not required, but I'm doing it anyway. And the second one is I'm afraid that, you know, even if it's just, you know, if it's an outlying opinion, even if it's a da'at yachid, I'm concerned that it may be something that's required of me. Right? Within that first category of supererogatory chumrah, right, you have different rationales for it. Right, we're familiar with the Ramban at the beginning of Parshat Kedoshim. Is it okay if I speak in English? The idea of kadeshet atmecha b'mutar lach, right? That the idea, you know, that's implied by the Ramban's word of kadeshet atmecha b'mutar lach, right? Is you have something that's mutar, you have something that's permissible to me, but I'm sanctifying myself by cutting myself off, by limiting myself, by restricting from myself that which is permissible. Right? Another aspect that's discussed is the idea of, especially in Hasidic circles, the idea of Timayim Hapanim Lapanim, a pasuk in Mishle, that God is like a mirror to us, that the way that we act toward God is the way that God acts toward us, or Hashem Tzilchan, that God is your shadow. Right? That the way that we act toward God is the way that God acts toward us. So, by doing something, by if we act toward God, l'fnei mishurat hadin, and if we act, you know, vis-a-vis our religious obligations, l'fnei mishurat hadin, doing things for God, even if we don't necessarily have to, then our hope is that God responds in kind by doing things for us that he doesn't necessarily have to. That even if by the letter of the law we deserve X, Y, and Z punishment, that God will act toward us, l'fnei mishurat hadin, you know, and bestow good upon us. Another aspect that comes up in this context is the idea of eit la'asot l'ashem, or l'migdar milta, right, that we withdraw into, you know, even away from that which is permitted to us because, you know, because of societal pressures, because we need to, you know, even by doing things that are mutar, there, you know, it might constitute some kind of slippery slope. Right, like if you, you know, you know, when it comes to things like tzniut, or when it comes to things like kashrut, if we allow, you know, if we allow a chink in the armor, if we allow a small hole in the dam, then you know, it won't be able to stem the tide.
Are you still working within those two first categories?
So this is even within the first category of going beyond that which is required, of supererogatory chumrah. And I'm just providing just a basic overview of the different rationales for that. And this is still by way of introduction. You know, and another is a social marker that you know, that I take on a chumrah as a social marker to distinguish myself from you know, from others, right? And this is a typical response when it becomes too easy to keep halacha, right? And a good example is kashrut in Israel, right? You walk into a supermarket, you buy something, you don't really have to look at the label, you can just presume that it's kosher, right? So there's an entire movement, an entire market for people to buy things that, you know, like that there's a pressure to, you know, kashrut is something that I have to do consciously, kashrut is something that I have to do in order to be different, which is the basic idea of kashrut is to, you know, lahavdil ben kodesh l'chol. So if I do it by default, it doesn't really count. So I want to show that I'm doing it as a, you know, as a social marker, as a form of restriction, right? So I take on chumrot, which force me to restrict my diet even from that which is available in today's supermarket, right? And vegetarianism might have a similar rationale. For all I know, I'm not a vegetarian.
There's one more question on the categories that you're building right now. These are you looking from above, or Benny Brown looking from above, or is that language actually referred to the tshuvot themselves?
No, I haven't gotten to Rav Moshe Feinstein yet.
No, I'm saying b'chlal. In other words, if you open up the tshuvot.
Okay, I'm looking at it.
Is there self-awareness of that kind of, in other words, the last kind of category?
In shooting, in
The
latter one, you're probably not gonna see that. No, that's a, it's a sociological observation.
Right.
That it's not a. You might find it in other terms, and you might be able to see, like, you know, an explanation, and that's, you know, and it's clear that that's the you know, that that's what they're getting at. But it is it's a sociological observation, and not a, you know, and not a religious. You know, it's not a religious motivation.
Right. But you still have to keep your eye on those. You can't assume that everything you're buying is kosher.
Fair enough. I'm saying that it's.
I was in Machmeh Yehuda the other day, for example, and.
Sure, they had questions of.
Did they take too
much? Tumot and night, Masrot, sure.
And he said, it came from a Jewish farm. It's got to be kosher.
Of course it does.
So I said, thank you, but no thank you.
Right. So I have a picture of Baba Sali on the wall. It's got to be kosher. Right. So the second approach, right, the idea of the second type of chumrah of acting out of concern that something may be required is you know, what you might call halachic hypochondria. Right, that it's you know, I'm afraid of being of violating some kind of yisur, and therefore I you know, I take on a chumrah, or you know, the in the world of in the Brisker approach, as it, you know, as it's commonly understood, right, there's a machloket rishonim. Who are we to paskin? And therefore, we have to try to be yotzei all of the dayot, right? So that creates a situation of chumrah. But if you ask them, I'm not being machmir. I just don't know. Right? I just don't know what's the correct way to do things. Therefore, I have to be concerned for them all. Right, but in general, it's a function of doubt, it's a fake, or a function of fear, right? That I'm afraid of violating the word of God. Okay, so that's by way of introduction. Okay, when we get to the Mishnah Brura, right, and the article that I sent out, the Mishnah Brura is almost going to serve in the context of this Chabura, the Mishnah Brura is almost going to serve as a foil for the Igrot Moshe, right? That I think that it just kind of it frames the uniqueness of the Igrot Moshe very nicely. So according to the Brown article that I sent out, the Mishnah Brura essentially takes that approach of chumrah based on the concern that something may be required, but he softens it. He doesn't say, since we're not sure, you have to do this, right? He uses that to stake out kind of, you know, a lenient position, a lenient pole, and a stringent pole, and he says the lenient pole is reliable, but the stringent pole is preferable. Right? So he, you know, he won't come out and say you have to be Yotze, the most stringent position. Right? It's, you know, one of the things that Brown emphasizes is that he does give the learner of the Mishnah Berurah the independence to really, you know, to make their own choices. Right? But he's clearly pointing you in a particular direction. The four excerpts that I printed out of the, you know, the, I think they're very good summaries of of Brown's approach to the Mishnah Berurah. Right? So, you know, I'll read them out because it's really very brief, and then we'll go on to the we can now summarize the findings of the previous sections as follows. The Chofetz Chaim did not invent the soft stringency, but the fact that he used it to such a large degree makes it a typical formulation of his ruling. Soft stringency does not constitute a non-ruling, meaning it's not that he's refusing to paskin, which would be the brisker approach, but it's rather a different type of ruling. After having displayed the leniency stringency spectrum, leaves the final decision up to the individual. This approach allows for leniency since it's legitimate to forego choosing the stringent option, even if it's less desirable. The soft stringency brings the Chofetz Chaim somewhat close to a mussarization of halacha, which complements the opposite process of halachization of mussar, known to us from the other writings of his, which I think is just a brilliant insight, that the Chofetz Chaim is blurring the boundary between mussar and halacha by use of soft stringency in the Mishnah Berurah, and also by basically taking areas that were traditionally thought of as mussar areas, like Lashon Hara, like Chesed, right, and turning them into halacha svarim. It also expresses a tacit conceptual approach that viewed the parameters of the precepts as vague due to the controversies regarding them. This stylistic pattern actually allows the simple Jew to decide to what degree he wishes or is able to strive for the stringency. This somewhat radical approach can be explained by a number of factors that influenced the Chofetz Chaim, but the primary motivation was to meet the needs of a large number of Jews who were in a condition that prevented them from being able to ask for halachic guidance from rabbinic authorities. He developed this approach both as a response to the circumstances of the generation and as a solution to the internal tension that characterized the simple Jew ideal. Chofetz Chaim was quite innovative in addressing his books to laymen, and this seems to be part of a larger transformation that he made in his ideas in life, namely that the aspiration to promote the simple Jew ideal. As stated, this change was radical, particularly within the context of the Lithuanian Jewry that celebrated the elitist Torah scholar ideal. However, if my assessment is correct that the social factors that led to this democratization were rooted primarily in the historical circumstances of the period, then the change was not a principled preference, but rather a pragmatic way of dealing with the reality. It sought to provide a solution for all those Jews who had landed in distant locations without a rabbi, Torah scholar, or even a supportive community. As such, it's very possible that the transformation that the Chofetz Chaim brought about was the result of duress rather than preference or desire. If so, then regarding the individual's lack of status in halachic decision-making, the contemporary Haredi ethos has turned back the clock to an approach that's the opposite of the Chofetz Chaim. It's questionable whether the Chofetz Chaim would find this regrettable. He's saying that the Chofetz Chaim, it's not that the Chofetz Chaim necessarily... The Chofetz Chaim might like the fact that the chumras that he described as soft are now considered hard chumras, right? They've become hard stringencies that are almost as if they were obligations. And the Chofetz Chaim... Right. Let's move on from there. Okay? You have it, and... So in the final analysis, I think this is a key point to understanding the Chofetz Chaim and the difference between the Chofetz Chaim and Rav Moshe. The Chofetz Chaim did not create kulot. Right? He didn't innovate kulot. Right? There were maybe a couple of occasions where he, you know, there are certainly occasions where he tried to be melamed zchut when people were already being mekel, but it's very rare that he comes up with a brand new reading of a situation in order to enable a kula.
Cross the theorist.
I'm sure he knew that Gemara.
Why do we take off that Terah? Let's just take off that Terah is because they evidently delved into the halacha. It's easy to say,
right.
Awesome.
Right.
But to give a heter,
you must know your stuff.
You must know your stuff.
And have broader shoulders.
Yeah.
Right. But I don't know to the degree to which the Chafetz Chaim innovated chumras either. Like, there were times that he tried to, you know, what he did was he amalgamated chumras. Right, that he one of the Chafetz Chaim's primary motivations was, lo titko to do. He wanted to homogenize minhagim. Right, so to that degree, like, you know, for example, when he talks about tilling on chol moed, right, whereas he has this famous diatribe against lo titko to do, what he suggests is that everybody put on tefillin until Hallel, and nobody make a bracha, right? So therefore, the people that say that you should do, you know, you're yotzei according to everybody, whereas it's almost like a disrespect for minhagim, meaning my family minhagim is you don't do it, your family minhagim is you put them on with a bracha, right? So he's trying to amalgamate a way that everybody's, you know, that he's...
Yeah, I used to have an issue on Cabrini. Near Wayu.
Okay.
180th Street. Right? So if somebody put on filling, they would tell them they have to
go into
the other.
Right, and in Breuer's, a couple blocks away,
today,
with the bracha. Filling with the bracha.
Today it's successful. No, nobody would put on the bracha.
In Breuer's?
Breuer's?
Pretty sure. I think my grandfather was a yak. He.
In Eric's children, nobody would.
I'm aware. Oh, but there are people that put them on at home on Chol Hamoed. On some kibbutzim, I believe they still do. Meaning, their kibbutz adati preserved a lot of the Ashkenaz minhagim. That was, they still dive in this with Ashkenaz on most of the HaKibbutz Hadati movement.
Yeah, the whole thing with the last day of Yom Tov, right? It's a big shiloh because people don't put on tefillin, and that's only the second day of Yom Tov is only the rabbanon, it's not the Yoraisa. Tefillin is the Yoraisa.
Right.
So I asked that question, I was told it's the Sheva Apostle.
I heard, and I don't want to get into discussions of these things. I've heard that Shlomo Zalman instructed people, if people that were keeping 2 days, to put tefillin on without a bracha on the second day, on what in Israel is Ishru Chag. But, whatever. Yeah, I don't have that problem anymore. I'm a Ben Eretz Yisrael. Okay. So, first of all, the Mishnah Berurah wasn't as much of a machadesh in general. I mean, he's, you know, in his introduction he writes that he's bringing all of the other shitot into one place, but he stakes out a minimum position and a maximum position, and he didn't innovate kulot. Right? He wasn't creating kulot. He was recording kulot. He was collecting kulot and saying, like, from amongst the possible lenient positions, he was staking out what's the most lenient acceptable position. If you've read the article that I sent out by Pinchas Pelle, you have some of the basic contours of Rav Moshe's halachic work as an American posek, as the quintessential American posek. Or if you've read the article that I wrote a few months ago for Rav Moshe's on the occasion of Rav Moshe's 25th yard site for Jewish Ideas Daily. Also, some of the basic contours are there. From that perspective, there are some similarities between, there's some apparent similarities between Rav Moshe and the Mishnah Berurah and the Chafetz Chaim. No worries. One of them is the language of soft stringency. Right? Rav Moshe uses the language of soft stringency fairly frequently, or it's the soft stringency's twin. The twin of soft stringency would be reluctant leniency. Right? Reluctant cool. It's like, if you bang me into a corner and I'll tell you, okay, you can do it this way, but I'm not crazy about it. Right? That's the language of reluctant leniency. Right? A classic case is Mechitza. Right? Rav Moshe is dealing with the question, and this is a question that comes up in the American milieu time and time again, what's the minimum requirement of a Mechitza? Right? And this is, when Rav Moshe is answering this question, you have to realize, it's tantamount to answering the question, where's the border between orthodoxy and conservative? Right? Because Mechitza is the border. Mechitza is the boundary. Like, Pshuto Kimashmo, Mechitza means, it means a divider, right? Mechitza, the divider, was the divider between orthodox and conservative. At least it became that. The last, there are no longer any OU-affiliated synagogues that don't have mechitzas. The last one went over about 10 years ago. It was Bethville in Baltimore.
Actually, BMH in Denver doesn't have mechitza on the upstairs one.
Columbus also.
Right.
And they're still OU-affiliated?
Yes.
I mean, there are other...
Denver is official.
Okay.
But is it an official shul?
I mean, is it official?
Is it a shul? Let's say I davened in the house.
Right.
I davened in the house.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's OU membership.
It's a shul.
OU membership. That's what I'm saying. Meaning, there are plenty of places that, they don't have a mechitza, but they use the art school sitter, but,
mechitza is the...
today, for sure, but I'm saying they got grandfathered in.
Right. Right, anyway, they're certainly not going to accept a new minion that doesn't have a mechitza. The way that Rav Moshe formulates it when he says what the minimum shiur is, says that the minimum shiur is 10 tefachim, right?
40 inches.
No, but it's he says it's higher.
He says a bunch of different things, but the
latter two,
but also 60.
He never says 5 foot.
5 feet. He never says 40.
But the language that he uses when he says that is just, right? Which means, if I understand it correctly, that it's a kosher mechitza, but all of the really firm people in the shul have to complain about it, because ain ruach chachamim no chahimenu. Means, and I'm a chacham, so I can't be happy with it. So I'm supposed to grumble. As Moshe says, I'm supposed to grumble about the height of the mechitza. So that's the halacha, that it's a kosher mechitza, but the frumach have to complain about it. That's the. Of course. Yeah. So he addresses the issue of whether or not the purpose of, he says that the purpose of mechitza has nothing to do with transparency, right? That a mechitza can theoretically be transparent, right? That the point is to create a physical barrier between men and women.
So you don't go love
with mechitza, glass mechitza, whatever. If anyone wants to give a chabur on that. We'll see what kind of audience you get. I should talk. Okay. So apparently what Rav Moshe is doing is he's allowing for a hierarchy of observance, similar to what the Mishnah Berurah does, meaning that there's the basic level, and there's the level to aspire to, right? You have this is the baseline of what's kosher, what you're, is okay, and then you have what you should aspire to. So, but I want to argue that in some ways, Igros Moshe is the diametric opposite of what the Mishnah Berurah is trying to do. I have several examples of, tshuvas that I printed up. I'll show you what I mean. Okay, so the first tshuva that I printed that you have is famous tshuva about Chol of Yisrael. Okay, so the way that he the issue of Chol of Yisrael is as follows. The Chumrah, now let's take a look at the at the tshuva first. I didn't bring the whole tshuva. There's some dot, dot, dot. That means that I didn't quote it. Somebody else want to read it? Or I'm fine doing it. So. Okay. Uvidvar hachalav shall accompany you. Right. B'medina tenu. Asher yesh pikuach hamemsala. There's government supervision. V'im ya'arvu chalav behemat mecha ye'amshu. And they will face punishment if they mix in...
Fine.
Hmm?
Yeah, they'll
Be punished. If they get... there will be punitive measures if they mix in non-cow's milk. Right? Anything but cow's milk. The gum, yes, you at the Ezek Shalhem. They'll shut them down. Shalhem vadai mirtati. Right? Mirtat is right. They're afraid. They're deterred. Right? Mila arev. Right? They're afraid to mix anything else in. They're afraid of doing any funny business. Yesh ta'am gadol lahatir af lo pshitat ha'prach. There's a good reason to be matir even without the Pri Chadash. Right? The Pri Chadash was an earlier position that a lot of people relied on, that basically got around the problem of chalav nochri. Mishum de'ikar de'idia brura tiri'iyah mamish. Right? So he uses this principle that if you know something, then it's like you saw it, right? If it's clear to you, if it's an absolute clear knowledge, then it's like you saw it. Kehadishvut das daflamadamit gamle edut de mamon. Right? He brings several examples, right, from various areas of halacha where knowing something clearly, completely, absolutely is considered something that you can rely on. It's considered a dude. The zehu geder anan sahadi shematzinu baharbe mekomot. And that's the principle of anan sahadi. Right? It means that we are meid. We are meid. Right? We testify that this is the case.
Right? Which is so important, because the whole point here is that essentially who's the shomer? Can you have a non-Jewish shomer here?
But what he's saying is that we're all the shomer.
Right.
So we are all able.
Knowledge is as if we were in the plant seeing ourselves.
Which means that there's a misunderstanding here. It's not that, classically, there were two categories of milk. There's Cholav Yisrael, right? There's milk, a Jew witnessed the milking. And there was Cholav Nochri, where the milking happened in a black box, and we don't know whether or not it's really cow's milk, and therefore we're afraid that pig's milk got mixed in, and so we're not allowed to drink it, right? So there's this idea out there that Rav Moshe created a third category called cholav accompanies, stam cholav, right? Which you can rely on, which you're allowed to drink it, and it's a third category. But that's not what Rav Moshe is saying. He's saying we're being made that this is 100% cow's milk, which means this is Cholav Yisrael.
If
FDA approved milk is Cholav Yisrael. That Baskin Robbins and Fendi's are Cholav Yisrael.
Because
you would consider it that a Jew saw the milking taking place. That is the basis of his hazard. There's no third category. But now watch what he does. Watch what he does. In a couple of lines, we'll see. So in a case where, just like you would be matir, a Jew witnessed a non-Jew milking the cow, that's the case with all of this cholav company, right? It's as if a Jew is witnessing a non-Jew milking it. This is on the next page.
Right.
Top of the next page.
No,
you think that it just actually as if, that's the basis of the heter. It is as if a Jew witnessed, right? Revolutionary, right? It's okay.
Well, in this particular case, if my memory serves me correct, the Gemara talks about where you have a non-Jew milking the cow, the Jewish owner of the cow or the farm or whatever, is not around, but he could turn up at any point, and therefore...
Right, so that's mirkati.
Right, even though that was not technically causing something, and you didn't milk the cow,
right.
Mirkati brought the fear that the non-Jew has, that, et cetera.
Yeah, fear of the Jew.
Maybe that if he's done it. But I don't think he's saying
that it is called Yisrael. Exactly what he's saying.
I'm not saying it's Kiria. It's not, Kiria doesn't mean that it is Re'ia.
So you always have the question of, because obviously it's, yeah. Meaning it's not actually Re'ia, because the Jews did not actually...
If you buy milk in America, mm-hmm. it says OU on it. It's not called Yisrael.
But
yes,
Again,
yeah.
That's based on this idea that there are three categories of milk. There's kosher, treif, and chol yisrael. But the basis of the Moshe's Keter is that our complete and total knowledge that this is 100% FDA approved cow's milk makes it as though it was witnessed by a Jew. Okay?
They're not willing to take the chance.
But then, in the last three lines, watch what he does. Avol mikol makom. Nevertheless, Lubaale Nefesh, right, for people who are, soulful. Right? For meticulous people, Min Harui Lahmir. It's proper to be Mahmir, but Aimba Zemishum Yuhara, and it's not considered an unnecessary type of hubris. The Kafanino Heg Lahmir. I also have the meaning of being Mahmir Lahmi. Aval, Misharotel Lahakil who ose kibina. Right? If somebody wants to be Mekel, he is Kibin. Right? So what he's saying is that Me'ikr Hadin, the halacha is that this milk is fine. More than that, it's Chalav Yisrael. And then what he does is he invents a chumrah called Chalav Yisrael. Chalav Yisrael used to be a halacha. You have to keep Chalav Yisrael. Right? Because otherwise, it might be trade. What Rav Moshe does is he takes Chol of HaKompanis, turns it into Chol of Yisrael, and then takes the stuff that, the Pride of the Farm stuff that goes bad after 2 days, I'm not saying that Pride of the Farm, I'm saying the Chol of Yisrael stuff that, it's shipped across country,
Chol of Yisrael,
I don't want to get sued, correct, because it's just the stuff that, is notorious for spoiling sooner, like, turn that into a chumra, right? Invented a new chumrah.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is people then the concept of keeping ikar din considered to be mekel?
No.
But he says that mishotel hakel. So you're being lakel and ikar. Either you're keeping ikar din or you're being mekel on something.
Right. So he's saying that it is mekel objectively speaking.
No,
it's more mekel than the machmir position.
But he's just not keeping the chumrah. The chumrah is supposed to be above. And
Mako is
supposed to find a way to be lenient on, right?
Right. So he doesn't. But what he does in the last line is he's saying that somebody who accepts the lenient position that Cholav HaKompanis is kosher, right, is Oseh Kedina, meaning he's not. And it says Ve'ein LaHachshivo K'mezalzel BeYisurin, and he shouldn't be one who considered taking sins lightly. He shouldn't be considered as though they're, as though they're relying on some kind of whacked out kula, right?
This clearly squarely fits into the first category that you spoke of in the beginning, which is Lifnei Mishurat Hadin.
That Chol of Yisrael today is Lifnei Mishurat Hadin. Now it happens to be that there are people that hold it Ikar Hadin. Chabad holds Chol of Yisrael is Ikar Hadin.
And you say that if you're a Mekel, meaning not to go to the Mishra Sadin, so you're still within the...
You're doing Kedina.
Right, so
right? The opposite of Lishnim Mishra Sadin is Lishnim Mishra Sadin.
Right.
I'm going according to the letter of the law.
This Kumbra, again, going back to the original category, this Kumbra is one of...
Correct. And
But in Eretz Yisrael, there is no such thing as Chol of Yisrael. It's all Chol of Yisrael. That's what I was
saying. Not true. Some of the ice cream that you can buy that's only a Rabbanut Hashkafa.
No, you mean the one that...
Important. Yeah, correct. Correct. They'll say the people have nothing. Chocolate and ice cream, yeah.
It's important, but any Chol that you buy here, if you buy any going to school and you buy it, it says Chol, that's Chol of Yisrael.
Correct. And if you... Yeah, I mean, it's very hard. You will not find a Mahajan Hashkafa on Chalav Nochri in this country. You will not. What can I tell you? So what Rav Moshe does in this tshuva, I mean, it's mind-boggling. So first of all, he takes what what was the baseline? The baseline was, the halacha, classically, was that Chalav Yisrael is halacha, right? You have to, the only milk that you can consume is Chalav Yisrael. Chalav Nachri, you can't consume. Right? That's the...
Yeah, but the reason...
The Gemara is halacha,
yeah,
okay?
The reason for Chalav Yisrael is because they used to mix.
Because, correct, because you weren't, because otherwise you couldn't be sure that they were mixed in mix. So hang on.
They don't mix today.
I understand. But what the strategy that he takes here is that he takes what had been considered the halacha, that Chalav Nochri is forbidden, and he converts it into a chumrah. Okay? Arguing that company milk is really Chalav Yisrael. And then he invents a new chumrah called Chalav Yisrael, and he encourages his observance. Okay, and it's those nimishurat hadin, as Yoni said, type of chumrah. So in contrast to the Mishnah Brura, the chiddush here is not that he lists the lenient position as. I mean, remember that the Mishnah Brura's chiddush, according to Brown, is that he lists the lenient position as a viable option. Right? The chiddush here is that he retains the rejected position as a chumrah and as something valuable. Right? So instead of b'yesh makom lehakel, right? That you know, if you need to be lenient, you can. Right? The chiddush here is yesh makom lehachmir. If you want to be machmir, you can. Okay? So that's.
Which is certainly necessary in a case like this where the rhetoric is anan shahadi, which is a very strong...
Right, you say edut.
You say, in other words, what he's saying is this is all about reality. The reality is, as you're putting it, that Chalav Yisrael is any milk.
Right.
And therefore, he really has to go to lengths to explain why, what kind of meaning there is in still searching on Chalav Yisrael.
Right. Well, he doesn't explain what the meaning is. He's saying that it's valuable, but he doesn't... Explain what the value is.
Correct.
Right.
In other words, rhetorically, he's trying to.
Right.
And therefore, just as you said, that the, you know, Enu Chacham Nochemenu is rhetorically strong. Here as well, what? I'm not a Baal Nefesh. I don't
right.
care. In other words,
right.
there is, he has to play with it.
Right. And he definitely is trying to hedge between them the Baal Nefesh should be Machmir, but somebody who's not Machmir, he's not being Mazalzel the Yisurin.
The question is, why is there a difference? Technically speaking, I mean, if he says that the regular milk is Chalav Yisrael, then what's the difference between the regular milk?
Correct. Meaning that you still have to answer the question. So why does he need to keep this chumrah? If and this gets back to the well, it gets back to something that his sons have testified about him, and his son-in-law has testified about him, and something that he basically writes himself in the introduction. He doesn't give a kula unless he thinks it's 100% true. Right? He will not have his arm twisted to give a kula. If he thinks that there's a certain kula, you know, makel position that's wrong, he will not permit it. Right? If he gives a kula, it means he thinks that this is correct, right? That the halacha is lahakel in this case, right? And if he's mas, right, and if he retains the chumrah, the question is why does he retain the chumrah? He doesn't have his arm twisted to give a kula. But he might allow for, he might keep a chumrah, even if he clearly thinks it's not the halacha. Okay? The next,
He's probably very valid.
What's that?
What he said, it's very valid. In other words, if his heter,
right.
is Chalav Yisrael, then why is he being mocked there?
Correct. That's the question that we'll answer. We'll come back to that. We're going to come back to the question, okay, so why is he doing this? So at first, I want to chart out the what before we get to the why.
Not mixed stanza.
What's that?
So that it shouldn't be too mixed stanza.
Exactly. Okay. The next tshuva. I brought the whole thing. We're not going to go through the whole thing, but I brought the whole thing just so you can see the degree to which he's using a certain type of rhetoric. The question was, and it's a question that came up recently here in Medinat Yisrael, the question was about, the Gemara says that women cannot are not allowed to teach boys. Gemara in Kiddushin, Mishnah in Kiddushin, women are not allowed to teach boys because we're afraid that there's going to end up being some kind of yichud between the woman and, if they're older boys, the boys themselves, or otherwise the boys' fathers.
Because it might lead to mixed
in. Exactly. Okay. So there were actually several questions in this too, but I just brought when he addresses this question. Right? They take women to be, to teach boys. And nobody lifts a finger. Nobody says anything. Okay, so now, before we go to the tshuva, right, I'm putting that question to you. Why is it that nowadays we don't think there's an issue of any kind of yichud issue when women teach boys?
Because they're all in the same room together. That's not yichud.
Well, the initial assumption was that at some point it would...
You're worried about after class.
You're always worried about after class.
So that's what you're worried about. In other words, while there's...
Why are we no longer worried about after class?
If there are two men on an elevator with a woman, it's not a problem.
I know. Why are we no longer worried about what happens after class? Why aren't we afraid that after class, a man comes to pick up his son and, ends up being in the same room as a woman, right? And that, that could lead to other things. Why are we no longer concerned about that?
It could be that our schools are much more public than they were back then.
Right.
Did it mean home?
Used to be in homes. It used to be one-room schoolhouses. It used to be a seder, which literally means it's a room. Right? It's a room. It's a one-room schoolhouse. Now, big schools, hundreds of people, lots of adults walking in and out. It's a completely different reality. Right? Intuitively, that's the answer. It took us 2 minutes to come up with that. And that's the answer that Rav Moshe ultimately gives. Right? He ultimately says, we're talking about much bigger schools. After going through 2 whole pages saying why Taka Geh is a problem. Right, so here, he isn't machmir. He doesn't say that a Baal Nefesh should be machmir. He doesn't say that. But he's machmir rhetorically. Right? You take a look at what he says. He named the Dvarim Shesha'al Kod Torato Yesha Kashela Hashiv Mishum Dmei Kilim B'medinatenu Mitzad HaDzak. Right, you might say that they're makel because there's pressures. Harbei gam shabo b'shatat tzak, but sometimes it's not shatat tzak. They ain't mochin b'davar. Nobody says anything. Shabbat tzak tam. We definitely need to explain this. We need to rationalize this. De'ikam al shabokim nashim l'morod bein d'limudei kodesh bein d'limudei chol hatzarik tam. The fact that women are hired as teachers, we need to give a reason. Da'at kanan b'kidushim and af tevi. We have a mission in Kiddushin. Lo tilma tilamed isha sofrim. A woman shouldn't teach children, school children. Afilu im tinoko, even little children, kitane kitanim, yishum abahata di yinuki, because of their fathers. V'ipsik b'rambam, v'shulchan aruch, v'paskin, v'alach v'psuka, rambam, shulchan aruch, v'shnim komos, in 2 different places, chana v'chesed mishna, parak beis, v'metal matora, halach adalda, afilu nesua, even if the woman's married, kevan de'in darach ha'ish liyos tamid b'veso. Since the man is not normally at home. A man's not home. So it's like that a man teaching girls isn't as much of a problem because his wife will be at home and will be able to watch. But a woman teaching boys in her home, that's more of a problem because her husband isn't usually at home. Right? And he goes into like the different explanations of the Kesef Mishnah and the way that the Achronim understand the Kesef Mishnah. And it says, he comes up with he ends with the Taz, and Fire Shataz, Kavanah, the Kesef Mishnah, then he came unto Ika Korba Tfei Mitzad B'nehem, since there's more of a relationship between the woman and the son, and the woman, and therefore the woman and the father, is Ika Isser Yichud, Afki Sha'abala Ishaim Be'ir. Right? There's an Isser Yichud, meaning this is not just your regular Isser Yichud, right? Where normally Bala Be'ir, where the husband might show up at any time, or if he's around, right? Would break Yichud, would interrupt that seclusion. Right? Since there's more of a korva, there's a relationship, a teacher-student relationship that develops, and a teacher develops a relationship with the parents as well, they have to be extra careful. It's an added chumrah on yichud. Right? So he's saying that the normal rules of yichud here are not enough. Even if the normal rules of yichud wouldn't apply, there's a special rule of yichud that applies here. Right? But then eventually he says, so women teach today in secular studies, they teach young boys and older boys, they mocha. Even though there is definitely a lack of teachers, and also because women, you know, to hire men costs a lot more. Right? Tafsir Kaftash, 1969. Okay?
Hey. That was the moment.
Exactly. Right? By the way, notice, by the way, it's Hey Eeyore Tafsir Kaftash. Right? It's dated Hey Eeyore. He doesn't note that it's Yom Ha'atzmaut for some odd reason. Uh-oh. Sorry. We still need to come up with a heter. And he goes for another paragraph. Right? Until at the end of this next paragraph, since here there are very few teachers who teach in their homes, and all of the teaching is in a general school, a large schoolhouse, right, which we call yeshivas ketanos, look at this. This doesn't apply. So after a whole pillful of why it's really, really, really a problem, he comes up with the answer that it took us about a minute to come up with, which is so intuitive as to be obvious.
I mean, you don't generally say, well, for
reasons
the law doesn't exist anymore, we can get rid of the law.
Unless you're
a Moshe.
No, you can,
because but the strategy here, and this is a general strategy for, you know, you're not saying that the reason for the law doesn't apply, you're saying that the law applied to a different reality.
Right.
Meaning that the law was formulated to apply to a particular set of circumstances, and this does not fit that set of circumstances. Meaning it's not saying, well, you know, since the reason isn't there anymore, it's a different set of circumstances. It sidesteps the issue rather than, it doesn't steamroll the reason, it sidesteps the reason. Right, which is
from the milk, from the
Chol
Yisrael.
What's that?
How's this different from the Chol
Yisrael? Okay, so it's different from the Chol Yisrael because he doesn't at the end of the tshuva say, but if somebody really wants to be from, they should send their kids to a school where only the, you know, their boys will be taught only by men.
Yeah, and you would have asked them, you would have said that.
Probably wouldn't have. You probably wouldn't have for the particular reason because as opposed to Chol Yisrael, somebody can take on the chumrah of Chol Yisrael individually. This is the kind of thing that a person cannot take on that chumrah individually. What, you're going to start your own school for the Bali Nevesh? Right? Meaning, and Rav Moshe would never have said something like that if it's going to cause a school.
Rav Moshe signed the Torah Mitzvah letter.
Right?
We're saying ushering
public education.
Right. So that's exactly this.
Ushering what? Hang on.
Oh, that's co-ed, right. Okay.
Co-education is, well, he deals with co-education, and he's ambivalent on co-education, meaning he talks about until what age is co-education accepted.
No, would it, according to this, would you be allowed to send your children to an after-school program and someone's house where a woman was teaching in her house then?
I don't know if he answered that question, but it could be that he would be machmer. Like, there's a very strong chance.
That would be the law in that case.
Right.
Not being machmer.
Right. Correct. Meaning he would apply the Iker Hadin. He would probably, yeah.
With all due respect, I don't necessarily buy your answer to the question. I mean, about change, the reason's not there, so you change the law. You know, I mean, it's...
Okay, fine. Right. Whatever. It's just, you know... It's a different discussion about when you
can... American now, there's a tendency now for... They're starting these programs where the kids...
Charter schools.
Where they're going to the public schools and they're... Because the cost of education is...
So, Rav Moshe then goes on in the last two paragraphs to say, not only can they teach secular studies, they can also teach Jewish studies, they can teach older boys, they can teach younger boys, and they can even teach in public school. Right? So he ends up giving like a blanket heter that basically a woman can teach anything as long as it's a large school. Okay? First of all, I want to note my disagreement with those who read this tshuva as an expression of Rav Moshe's attitude toward feminism. I don't think this has anything to do with feminism. I don't think it has anything to do with women learning, which some also wanted to read, you know, that Rav Moshe's psak here has to do with women. I think that reading is actually a bunch of baloney. Fine. What I think Rav Moshe's doing here, he spends a long time clarifying why it should be usher before he acknowledges that we're backed into the corner and there's a shahad tzak, right? And there's monetary, economic duress here, and therefore we have to find a heter. Right? And then he comes up with a blanket heter, which is obvious and intuitive. So the question is, why spend so much time? Why go through that whole process? Why spend so much time saying why it should be usher? And why give the impression that you're being backed into a corner when the distinction is intuitive? What I want to say is that here in this instance, in this tshuva, Rav Moshe is using chumrah purely rhetorically, right? He doesn't even retain it as something in the end. He doesn't say at the end that a baal nefesh should be machmir, right? So I think it's all, in some ways it's an archetype for other instances of chumrah and igros Moshe that he's basically throwing a bone, he's throwing a rhetorical bone to the baseline halacha that he's moving away from. To the former conditions that the halacha dealt with, to make it seem like he's reluctant to move away from it. Right? He's saying he doesn't want to move away from the halacha.
What is his, in other words, just to challenge that a bit?
Okay.
For you, maybe for us, sort of obviously, you can look at a mission, you can look at a Gemara Kedushin and say, that applies to a specific social context, right? Which doesn't exist anymore. Even though it says school there, and it says school in your question, we're talking about two different realities.
That
is obvious if it's two minutes to come up with it.
Right.
I think it's possible that for Rav Moshe, that's a major jump to say that we are dealing with a new chetra, a new thing, that the schools are built differently, and people come in and out. Maybe he reads the mission and he says, you see school, and it says school, and that's that. And therefore, it's not necessarily rhetorical.
Okay, fair enough.
I'd like to offer a different approach, which is that this is just an opportunity for him to launch into one of the things that he might feel, especially in the year that he's in, this whole business of mixed dancing, right? It's an opportunity to make sure that it is
before Woodstock, but
yeah.
He saw it coming.
He talks about this all over there. He feels the winds of change coming from his Lower East Side apartment.
Already in America, which was so drastically different from Europe, there was an opportunity for him to say, this is something, Gilead is a major issue that we have to watch out for, and he's in this diatribe. But in the end, this circumstance doesn't.
In which case, the diatribe is veiled, because he doesn't launch into a diatribe. He goes into a pill pull of why it should be awesome. He doesn't go into a diatribe.
He's talking about how important these different situations are.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
50 years ago, every one of these shoes had a dance there.
All right. I'm going to skip the last two tshuvas that I brought. The last two tshuvas that I brought were, one was a question of where you had like some society meeting, and they started off with the Dvar Torah, and the question was, were women allowed to stay for the Dvar Torah? And he says, well, you didn't ask me if women are allowed to be in the meeting, right? But if women are already in the meeting, there's no reason to kick them out for the Dvar Torah.
What's the reason that they wouldn't be allowed to stay for the Dvar Torah?
He says there's no reason that they wouldn't be allowed to stay because women's learning.
Well,
Women aren't allowed.
Women aren't allowed to learn Torah. He says that they for sure, you know, they should stick around for the Dvar Torah, because certainly there are halachos that women need to know, right? But you know, but the whole point is that he says b'medina senu, in this country, women participate in these meetings, right? So therefore, if they're already participating in the meetings, there's no reason to kick them out for the Dvar Torah. And then the last one is whether or not is about Thanksgiving, whether or not it's right. Oh, I love how he spells it. Whether or not there's an issue of chukas hadayin when it comes to Thanksgiving, you know, it seems that he contradicts himself in various tshuvas. In this tshuva, he says that you know, it's okay, but it's frivolous, right? You should never accept it as a minhag. But if every year you want to have a seuda, you have a seuda. Just never accept it as a minhag.
You shouldn't do it in a row.
No, he doesn't say that.
Well, he says it somewhere else.
There was a rub in America.
He contradicts himself in several places.
He says another tshuva that you shouldn't do it every year.
Right. No, so here he says that that every year you should make sure you're not being metabolized as a minhag, right? Right.
There's a rub in America who was declared a posseg for a much function every independence that he put out an American flag on his house.
All right. There's another great tshuva about Rav Moshe about flags and shul and whatever.
Oh, yeah.
That's
very good.
Okay.
Very good tshuva.
Anyhow, so we're not going to get into those. I want to get into here's where we get into the realm of speculation. You know, why is it that Rav Moshe has this rhetorical, uses as a rhetorical device the idea of a reluctance to be making. Whereas a rhetorical device, he almost, as it were, he pays tribute to Chumrah before moving away from it. So I have three factors that I think may have been motivating him. Offer them. Okay. One, issue number one is he's trying to build trust, right? That by offering reluctance, even if it's as a rhetorical device, he's showing his fealty to the traditional approach. Meaning, in all of these cases, he's basically saying that the reality here in America is different, right? He acknowledges that the realities in America are different, and that the realities in America warrant a different approach, whether it's because the schools are bigger in America, or it's because, you know, there's a purely secular holiday called Thanksgiving, or because women attend meetings, or because there's the FDA. Realities in America are different, and my psak will reflect the fact that the realities of America are different, but in order to demonstrate my fealty to the traditional approach, to show that I'm having that I'm coming from a traditional place, I have to, as it were, pay tribute, right? Tip my hat to the traditional approach, even if I ultimately acknowledge that the conditions here are different. And he does that basically to build trust amongst those, you know, those who are less likely to adapt to tradition, and the people that will end up being his category of Bali Nefesh, right? The people who aren't going to accept his kula, right? They'll still end up, you know, understanding like, oh, he recognizes that this is the traditional approach, but he's saying that, okay, there's room to be makel because things in America are different. So that's A. B is he's doing it in order to create solidarity within the Orthodox community. Rav Moshe Feinstein was very aware that American Jewish society, specifically at the time that he was, you know, from the 50s to the 80s, when he was most active, right, American Jewish society was fracturing, and that Orthodoxy was on the wane, right? You know, as the second generation of Jewish immigrants started moving out to suburbia, they all became conservative. Orthodoxy became a very small denomination, the smallest denomination. There were prophecies that Orthodoxy would cease to exist within a generation or two. One of the things that was part of his project was to differentiate the conservative movement from Orthodoxy. I mean, he wanted to draw a bright line between Orthodox and conservative, and at the same time, he very much wanted to retain solidarity within Orthodoxy, which means that even like the Fromots and, you know, on the Lower East Side, you know, and the people who belonged to an Orthodox synagogue but barely were from, who lived in Des Moines, Iowa, he wanted them to see each other as being part of the same community, as being committed to the same community. And to that end, by using the rhetoric of Chumrah, right, but actually offering Kula, he's able to embrace a wider swath of the Orthodox community, meaning he's able to, you know, he's able to include different elements of the community within his reach, right? You think that, like, yes, there's a baseline position and there's a Chumrah, right? So by doing this, I'm able to embrace you all. I'm able to keep you all under the same roof, as it were, under the same Orthodox umbrella. And the third element is that he wants to avoid the appearance of concession to the American milieu. Right? Meaning he's trying to create, he's coming from a place that's very traditional. Right? I don't think there's any accident that he was an adult. Right? He was well into his, he was almost 40 years old by the time he got to the United States. He was 40 years old when he got to the United States. Right? And he was known as a Gadol by the time he got to the United States. And he's coming from a very traditional place. Like, he's coming from a very traditional society, you know, one that in some ways I think he idealized. Right? And he talks about the ways things were in Europe often in his tshuva. So he's showing a willingness to accommodate American life. And in all of these examples that we gave, and in all of the reasons that I've offered so far, it all comes down to the difference between, it all comes down to responding to the American reality. So what he wants to do here is he wants to accommodate the American reality, but he doesn't want to idealize it. Right? So by using the language of reluctance, right, and using the rhetoric of Chumrah, right, it allows him to express his reservations about the entire idea of American Orthodoxy, the entire institution of American Orthodoxy, even while enabling it, meaning he's enabling American Orthodoxy, he's allowing Orthodoxy to function in America, but at the same time, he's showing that he doesn't want to paint it as an ideal. He doesn't want to paint it as something which is, you know, like he wants to show that his fealty remains with the idealized traditional society from which he emerged. Right, or to try to recreate that society.
You gotta remember, I mean, they were all staples here in Europe.
They weren't all staples. I mean, Warsaw wasn't a staple by the time.
The Orthodox people were all congregated in different cities that were, I mean, they used to put on their tefillin when they used to go to shul. They came to shul already prepared.
Yeah, and I think Rav Moshe grew up in the outskirts of Minsk, and I think that his experience probably did, you know.
It was destroyed. I mean, it doesn't exist there. What existed after the war was
the borough part of it.
To sum up.
Reincarnation.
To summarize. You know, I argued that Rav Moshe Feinstein often uses the language of soft chumrah and reluctant leniency as a rhetorical device. That in these cases he fundamentally believes the halacha to follow the lenient position, but he still writes using the language of reluctance or the language of chumrah. This is contrast with the Mishnah Brura, who rarely introduces original leniencies and uses the language in order to promote stringency, even while acknowledging even if he acknowledges the legitimacy of the leniency. Several reasons that, you know, for this strategy of Moshe Feinstein, all of which are linked to American Orthodox life, were number one to build trust amongst those who are more traditionally inclined. Number two was to stake out a wide range of acceptable Orthodox practice, so in order to encourage communal solidarity. And number three, it allowed him to express his reservations about the less than ideal conditions of Orthodoxy in America in general, which in his mind fell far, far short of the idealized traditional European society.
Sure.
Thank you.